Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. We'd like to give you a warm welcome to our Bible-based presentation this evening to the title, The Wonder of Creation, Proof of Divine Design. Once again, we'd like to give you a warm welcome to our Bible-based presentation this evening, where our speaker, Mr. Micah Hunter, will address us to the wonder of creation, proof of divine design. And he has asked that by way of introduction to his remarks this evening that we read from Genesis chapter 1. And so that reading, friends, serves as an introduction to Mr. Hunter's remarks tonight to the title, The Wonder of Creation, Proof of Divine Design. And I now call forward Mr. Hunter.
Well, thanks, Mr. Chairman, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen and young people. Tonight's topic is one of those subjects that in today's world actually takes a reasonable amount of courage to stand up and put your name against. Because, as you're probably aware, most educated people in our world today now believe that the theory of evolution is true. It's what they're taught in school, it's what they learn at university, and in higher academia, it's basically viewed as an unquestionable fact. So for me to stand here in public and claim that it's not true, for some would place me well and truly into the category of laughable simpleton. So as far as all these people are concerned, they believe that all life on Earth today originated long ago from single-celled organisms. And so the theory goes that over an immense amount of time, some of these organisms will randomly produce mutations. And some of those mutations are beneficial to survival. So if you happen to be one of those organisms with a beneficial mutation, you're more likely to survive longer and you're more likely to pass your genes onto the next generation. And so theoretically, over a long period of time, nature sifts out the weak organisms, and by survival of the fittest, only the strongest will pass on their genes, essentially. And apparently if you run this experiment for almost 4 billion years, you get us humans, which I find fascinating to contemplate. The problem is, not a word of it, I believe, is actually true, as I intend to show you this evening. I'm going to show you why the only worldview consistent with our universe is the worldview propounded by the Bible, the worldview in which human beings were intricately and purposefully created by God in his image. Now, when dealing with this subject, it's fairly common for religious people to be accused of stepping out of their field of expertise. It's said that religion should deal with spiritual things, and science should deal with natural things. I mean, on the surface, that seems quite reasonable. Take this quote from The Conversation, for example. Now, this quote is from an article in The Conversation, which is all about how few Australian students actually believe in creationism anymore. And the quote says this: "In contrast, most people who believe in God, but not literal creationism, accept that it should be the business of science to research the nature and origin of the natural world, and that it should be the business of religion to focus on life's meaning and purpose. Most mainstream theists, those who believe in the existence of one or more gods, don't see a major conflict between their religious beliefs and understanding about the reality of evolution. Accepting that the Genesis account may be an allegory, they see no major problem in accepting the possibility that evolution was God's method of creation." So do you see what they're saying in this quote? Religious people should stay in their own lane and stop worrying about subjects that don't concern them. We should just let science deal with nature and concern ourselves with the meaning of life, etc., all these spiritual questions. So why can't I just take some sort of middle ground here? If I want to cling on to my God, which I do, why can't I just accept that evolution might be his method of creation? What's wrong with that? Well, that's the first subject that we're going to deal with tonight as we progress through our topic this evening. Then after we've dealt with theistic evolution, as it's called, we're going to address evolution more generally. And to do that, I'll be presenting what I believe is a very powerful, incontrovertible argument which proves that the biblical God must have been the creator of human beings. So those are the two things we're going to cover this evening. So let's begin on the first of those points. And I suppose what we're trying to do here is answer the question, is evolution compatible with biblical theism? Can I believe in the divine inspiration of the Bible and also believe that evolution is true and be consistent with those two beliefs? Well, in order for us to be able to take that view, we'd have to assume that the creation account that we just read of in Genesis is not a literal account. Right? If Genesis says that God created everything in 6 days, but you believe that no, it actually happened over several billion years, then you have to account for that somehow. So the way people do that, of course, is by saying, well, the Genesis account is just an allegory. It's not intended to be taken literally. It's just a frilly, extravagant way of saying God was behind it all. But you see, immediately that we do this, we start to run into problems. Because if you say that Genesis 1 is just an allegory, or allegorical poetry, as they say it is, then you'd have to say that Genesis 2 is allegorical poetry as well. You see, it's all part of the same book and the same narrative. So you can't all of a sudden decide that chapter 2 is literal if chapter 1 is an allegory. And so we'd have to accept that Genesis 1 and 2 is both allegorical. And if you say Genesis 1 and 2 is allegorical poetry, then you'd have to say Genesis 3 is as well, and then Genesis 4, and then Genesis 5, because you have to be consistent. So you see, the trouble is now you've jumped onto this allegory train, and it doesn't look like stopping anytime soon. And before you know it, you've gotten all the way to Genesis chapter 11, and you haven't found a single stopping point. So now the Genesis flood has to be an allegory, and the Tower of Babel has to be an allegory. Who knows what it's an allegory of? Okay, so now we've got to Genesis 12. And funnily enough, this is where most theistic evolutionists draw the line. They're happy to say that Genesis 1 to 11 is an allegory. But the moment you get to Genesis 12, all of a sudden the life of Abraham is solid literal history. Now, if you haven't read these chapters, this might not seem like much of a problem. But let's take a look, if you'd like to turn them up, please, at the end of Genesis chapter 11 and the beginning of Genesis chapter 12, because we'd like to see if there's any credence at all to the claim that Genesis 11 is allegorical, but then Genesis 12 is suddenly literal. Well, if you're in Genesis 11 now, actually just take a quick look back to Genesis 10 verse 1. Now, remember that according to theistic evolutionists, we're deep in allegorical territory here. So none of this actually happened. It's all somehow an allegory. Genesis 10 verse 1. Now, these are the generations of the sons of Noah. So hopefully you remember Noah. He's the one who built Noah's Ark to escape the flood. So it says, these are the generations of the sons of Noah: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. So Noah had three sons: Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And remember that first name, Shem, because it's going to come up again. You see, if we take a look over the page at chapter 10, verse 22, we read about this man Shem again. It says, the children of Shem, Elam, and Asher, and Arphaxad, and Lud, and Aram, etc. So there's all the allegorical children of Shem, I suppose. And now, once more, let's flick over to chapter 11, still in the supposed allegory, and we read of Shem's children again, all the same names, chapter 11, verse 10. These are the generations of Shem. Shem was 100 years old and begat Arphaxad, 2 years after the flood. And so you can follow down these verses and you'll see that the record is very specific about who lived when and how long they lived for and the names of their children and so on. And eventually you actually get down to verse 26, which finally says, and Terah, so this is one of the great-great-great-grandsons of Shem, so Terah lived 70 years and begat Abram, Nahor, and Haran. Now you might know that when it says Abram, that's the same character we read of in the next chapter, chapter 12, which is apparently perfectly historically accurate and literal. So chapter 12, verse 1 says, now the Lord had said unto Abram, that's the same man, Abram, and so on. So somehow we have this great divide between chapter 11, which is supposedly allegory, and chapter 12, which is literal. But somehow we have the same character popping up in both of these chapters. So we have all these allegorical, non-literal characters like Adam and Eve, like Cain and Abel, like Noah, but then all of a sudden Abram, or Abraham, as you probably know him better, is perfectly literal. Yes, Abraham was a real person, but Adam and Eve weren't. So the problem I'm demonstrating to you here is that theistic evolutionists who try to impose the theory of evolution on the Bible, they have the problem of continuity, They have to say that Genesis 1 to 2 is allegorical, obviously, right? Because it's all about creation. But in so doing, they're forced to make so many other chapters allegorical as well, because there's no possible line you can actually draw in which the record clearly switches from being allegorical to being literal. And there's a simple reason for that. And the reason is that Genesis, and indeed the whole Bible, gives us a consistent, literal, unbroken historical timeline all the way from creation. And there's no way that you can break it up without doing serious violence to the text. Now, I'd like to bring you to one more proof text, which is actually in the New Testament this time, in the Gospel of Luke, to further drive home this point about the problem of continuity. Now, to me, I think this text proves beyond any doubt that Genesis is not an allegory, and that Adam and Eve were real literal people, the first people, in fact. So please turn up Luke chapter 3. Because in Luke chapter 3, we have another of these long genealogies that we've been looking at already this evening in Genesis. And it begins in verse 23, but this time it's going backwards, so from the present through to the past. So Luke 23 says, "And Jesus himself began to be about 30 years of age, being, as was supposed, the son of Joseph, which was the son of Heli." And so we might ask the question, and it's a pretty simple question, do we believe that Jesus was a literal person who actually lived? And of course, the answer will be yes, of course. Even atheists accept that Jesus was a real person. So if that's the case, then presumably the other two people mentioned in this verse are real as well. It says that he was the son of Joseph, who was the son of Heli. So presumably, since it's the same genealogy, Joseph and Heli were real people as well. And then we could cast our eyes down the genealogy, and we could keep reading, but we don't have time, to verse 31, where it's continuing the same genealogy, and it says, "Which was the son of Meliah, which was the son of Menon, which was the son of Mattathah, which was the son of Nathan, which was the son of David." And suddenly we think, well, I recognize that name. Everyone knows who King David was. Well, here he is cropping up in this genealogy. And we might ask, was David a literal person who actually lived? And of course, the answer is yes. There isn't any Bible-believing person, theistic evolutionist or not, who would deny that David was a real person. Well, you see, what's interesting about this genealogical record is that it doesn't stop at David, obviously. It keeps going. And it goes right past Abraham in verse 34, right in the middle of that verse. And funnily enough, all the names seem to be exactly the same names that we read in Genesis chapter 10 and chapter 11. See in verse 36, "Which was the son of Canaan, which was the son of Arphaxad, which was the son of Sem," that's Shem, the Semites, "which was the son of Noah," or No, which is the New Testament way of saying Noah. So we accepted that Jesus was real, and that his father Joseph was real, and that his great-great-grandfather David was real, and that Abraham was real. But you see, this record puts no allegorical break between all those characters who we accept are real and the supposedly allegorical characters in the first 11 chapters of Genesis. But it doesn't stop at Noah. If you look at verse 38, here's what we read. "Which was the son of Enos, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God." So in order to be consistent with this record, we are forced to say that every character listed in this genealogy literally existed. And what's more, Adam must have been the first, because before him there was only God. So the record says that God was the one who brought Adam into existence. So to me, this genealogy, which can sometimes come across as tedious and boring, is actually, to me, the most powerful proof against the idea of theistic evolution. Because if you're going to claim that Jesus was a real person and that David was a real person, then you have to believe that Adam was also a real, literal person, because they're all part of the same genealogical, continuous lineage. So that's the argument concerning the problem of continuity. And I think it forces you to make a choice. You can either have evolution, or you can have the Bible, but you can't have both. They're mutually exclusive. Now, there are actually many other powerful arguments against the idea of theistic evolution, all of which I'd be happy to discuss with you afterwards. But for now, we don't really have enough time to consider them. Suffice it to say that I cannot, as a believer in the Bible, be consistent with my own beliefs if I just let scientists have their say about the natural world and stick to supposedly so-called spiritual things myself. For one thing, evolution is not compatible with the Bible, as we've shown. But for another thing, this question about the origin of human beings, whilst it might be a question about nature, actually has also enormous spiritual and moral implications, as we're going to see. And of course, that's what we're going to find out by the time we reach the end of the next section of this talk, which is all about proving that God created all life on earth, and in particular, human beings. Now, in the lead up to writing this lecture, I came across this very interesting article in The Guardian. Somebody showed it to me, which was actually written in June of last year. The title of the article says, as you can see, "Do We Need a New Theory of Evolution?" And here's what the introduction says. "A new wave of scientists argues that mainstream evolutionary theory needs an urgent overhaul. Their opponents have dismissed them as misguided careerists, and the conflict may determine the future of biology." Now, before we begin on this, I want to be clear about what this article is saying and what this article is not saying. This new wave of scientists aren't claiming that God created the earth in 6 days. What they are saying is that there are a number of extremely important fundamental facts that the typical theory of evolution that you get taught in school doesn't account for. For one thing, it does not and cannot tell us where complex structures and organs come from in the first place. For example, evolution might try to explain why creatures with good eyesight tend to survive longer and pass on their good genes onto the next generation. But it doesn't explain where the eye came from in the first place. So here's a quote from the article to that effect. So it says, "The problem, according to a growing number of scientists, is that it, evolution, is absurdly crude and misleading. For one thing, it starts midway through the story, taking for granted the existence of light-sensitive cells, lenses, and irises, without explaining where they came from in the first place. Nor does it adequately explain how such delicate and easily disrupted components meshed together to form a single organ." So that's one problem that the article discusses. Another problem discussed in the article is to do with what's called plasticity, and the fact that organisms can change very quickly. They can respond to their environment and the things they eat and the things they do extremely quickly, more quickly than you might think, to the point where they can look almost completely different as a creature. And you might ask, well, how does that oppose the theory of evolution? Well, you see, the problem is that the theory of evolution claims that changes in species only really occur via minute genetic alterations that build up over a massive amount of time. So if plasticity shows that changes can occur extremely fast, then that raises some important questions. Let me read some more parts from the article to supplement this point. It says, "One of the most fascinating recent areas of research is known as plasticity, which has shown that some organisms have the potential to adapt more rapidly and more radically than was once thought." And then further down the article, it continues, and it describes this particular type of amphibious fish, that when you let it live in water, it looks and acts completely different to if you let it live on the land. And the article says this, "According to the traditional theory of evolution," so talking about this fish, "according to the traditional theory of evolution, this kind of change takes millions of years. But says Amin Moksek, an extended synthesis proponent, the Senegal beaker," so that's the fish I was talking about, "is adapting to land in a single generation." And he sounded almost proud of the fish, apparently. So in a single generation, this fish was producing changes that are supposed to take millions of years, according to the theory of evolution. So those are two problems that I've discussed here, and I think these are the two major contentions that this article brings to bear against the theory of evolution as it is commonly understood. But the reason why this is so fascinating to me is that creationists like myself do not deny that organisms can change an awful lot over time. So every dog, wolf, and dingo probably had one common ancestor. Every different type of horse probably had one common ancestor. The hammerhead shark and the giraffe, on the other hand, probably did not. So we do believe that changes can occur over time, but we firstly do not believe that that period of time is millions of years. We believe it's about 6,000 years. And secondly, we do not believe that if you simply allow natural processes to work themselves out, that you end up with something as complex and functional as an eye, or a heart, or a brain. In fact, almost everything you need for a functional organism, like a dog, had to already be there in order for the animals to exist and function and have the ability to change over time. And the point that this article makes, as we've discussed, is that A, you don't need millions of years for some of these changes to occur, and B, evolution cannot explain the existence of many of these complex organs and structures. So whilst this article isn't written in support of creationism in the least, as a creationist myself, I find some of the points it raises very interesting. So I think that even arguing from a naturalistic perspective like we just have, we can throw some reasonable doubt on the theory of evolution and even produce a strong case against it. And whilst all that is very useful, I think a much stronger case can be made by showing that the biblical worldview, in which the God of the Bible is the creator, is the only coherent basis upon which it is possible to understand the world and the way our very own minds work. Now, initially, this might sound slightly off topic to the subject of God being the creator. So bear with me while I tease out this argument, and I think by the end of it, you'll see the power and relevance of what I'm saying. So to begin this, we're going to consider a Bible story that is found right at the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis chapter 4. In a sense, it's the very first Bible story. So I'm just going to quickly summarize what most of you would recognize as the story of Cain and Abel, Genesis chapter 4. You see, there were two brothers, Cain the older brother and Abel the younger brother, and both of them brought offerings to God to worship him. And God had respect for Abel and for his offering, but he had no respect for Cain and for his offering. In other words, Abel's offering and his attitude was much better than Cain's, and so God accepted Abel, but he rejected Cain. Well, this made Cain rather jealous, as you can probably imagine. He couldn't handle the fact that God had accepted his brother, but not himself. And so, if you know the story, out of pure jealousy and hatred, he takes Abel out into the field and simply murders him. Now, I think on the most basic level, the lesson of this story is don't kill people. And I think we'd all agree that what Cain did to Abel was morally wrong. We'd call it morally wrong. Under any government, with any laws or any lack of laws, and at any time in history, this would be morally wrong. It doesn't matter what the historical and cultural context was. We just know that Cain's murder was wrong. But have you ever stopped to think how that we know that this was wrong? What is it that gives us the ability to make that moral judgment? In fact, when you think about it, we make moral judgments all day. Perhaps you thought that the green 2007 Mazda 2 was wrong to cut you off on the freeway this evening. They shouldn't have done it, is what you would have said. Or perhaps you think your boss was wrong to fire you. They shouldn't have done it, is what you would have said. Or perhaps you think your sibling was wrong to insult you. They shouldn't have done it, is what you would have said. So you see, we make these shouldn't have moral judgments every day. And whether or not these moral judgments are correct is beside the point. The fact remains that we have the ability to make them, and we do make them. We have the ability to think morally, to make moral judgments. That's not something a fish can do, or a giraffe, or a hammerhead shark. They might like or dislike things, but they cannot make moral judgments. The fish might say, I don't like the fact that the hammerhead shark is eating me. But the fish will never say the hammerhead shark shouldn't eat me, or that it's morally wrong for the hammerhead shark to eat me. And if you tried to explain that to a fish, it'd be like trying to explain what color is to a blind person, or what music is to a deaf person. That's just a dimension they can't even begin to comprehend. Only we humans can make those sorts of judgments. But why? What is it that makes us different? And what is it about us, how we were created, that allows us to pass moral judgments, whether or not they are right or wrong? Now, in answer to this question, I want to set up a couple of alternative perspectives and show you why that only one of them can possibly answer the question. So, the first perspective is the unbiblical or atheistic perspective. Now, if you don't believe that there is a God or that God has anything to do with morality, then you'd have to assume a position of what's called subjective moral relativism. And basically what that means is this. Suppose you're on the freeway and the green Mazda 2 pulls in front of you angrily, blowing their horn. Well, of course, from your perspective, you think they're absolutely in the wrong. They shouldn't have done that. And right in that moment, there's probably nothing more real to your mind that ever has been, that it shouldn't have been that way. So that's your perspective. But from the green Mazda driver's perspective, they were actually in an urgent rush to work. And the reason they used their horn was because their blinker doesn't work. So from their perspective, they haven't done anything morally wrong. In fact, they were really being quite polite by using their horn. So you have these two perspectives, but who's right? Or is either of them right? Well, you see, from a naturalistic, atheistic perspective, nobody is right, per se. There's no objective moral standard to adjudicate them. What's morally wrong to you might not be the same as what's morally wrong to me. I simply have my truth, and you simply have your truth. And of course, in our postmodern world, this ideology is becoming increasingly popular. But aside from the fact that this reasoning will quite clearly end in chaos, something that we don't have time to go into tonight, you might have noticed that it is a self-defeating argument. It isn't even consistent with itself. You see, every moral judgment you have ever made is effectively an appeal to something outside of yourself, some standard that you believe exists that the green Mazda should have obeyed, a standard which is there regardless of whether or not you exist and regardless of whether or not the Mazda was ever manufactured. And by making an appeal to that standard, whether or not you got that appeal right, you are assuming that everyone else should know the same standard. So if there is no objective standard, then every moral judgment you have ever made is meaningless. And now consider Cain and Abel for a moment. If you believe that Cain was morally wrong to murder Abel, by definition, you cannot also believe that Cain should be allowed to hold his own moral standard, in which murdering Abel might be considered morally right. It's impossible to hold these two beliefs at once, because on the one hand, you'd be saying, no, he can't murder Abel. But on the other hand, you'd be saying, he's allowed to hold his own moral convictions and act on them, so yes, he can murder Abel. So the two are contradictory. They cannot go together. Either you have an objective moral standard, or you don't have a moral compass at all. And thus, the fact that we do have a moral compass, the fact that we can think morally and pass moral judgments, is a testament to the fact that there is an objective moral standard to which we are all constantly appealing, whether or not we get those appeals correct. So then, why are we aware of this objective moral standard? What is it that makes us constantly aware of it? Well, as we've just seen, this atheistic, naturalistic perspective cannot answer the question. It's self-contradictory. So let's move on to the biblical perspective, where I think we have a different story. And to understand the biblical view, we're going to take a look at three Bible verses from the book of Genesis. Now, you might be thinking, why am I using Bible verses to try to prove the Bible correct? Isn't that just circular reasoning? Well, it's not, because what I'm really doing is presenting to you the only worldview capable of answering these questions about morality. And in order to do that, we need to read some Bible verses to see what the Bible has to say. And the first of those verses, if you'll turn back there for a moment, is Genesis 1, verse 26. This, of course, as we read, is the account of creation. We might actually begin reading in verse 24. It says in verse 24, "And God said, let the earth bring forth the living creature after his kind." This is why I should read the Bible and not what I've written on my... "After his kind, cattle and creeping thing and beast of the earth after his kind. And it was so. And God made the beast of the earth after his kind, and cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the earth after his kind. And God saw that it was good. Right, so here we have all the animals being created. And as it says at the end of the verse, God saw that it was good. So that's all the animals. But what comes next is the crowning moment of the entire creation account. It's almost like everything else was leading up to this point. Verse 26. And God said, let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea, and over the fowl of the air, and over the cattle, and over all the earth, and over every creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth. So here's the final act of creation, the formation of man. And do you notice the stark contrast between the creation of man compared to the creation of all the other animals that are in the previous verses? You see, only man was created in the image of God, and only man was to have dominion. In fact, man would have dominion over everything else on the earth. Man would be at the apex of it all. So clearly, there's something special about the creation of mankind, and it all stems from the fact that he was created in the image of God, or in the image and likeness of God, I should be more specific. Now, if mankind is created in the image and likeness of God, what we're being told is that God has placed some of his own divine attributes upon us. And thus, every person who has ever lived carries with them the burden, the responsibility, the privilege of bearing God's image. So if everyone bears God's image like this, what responsibilities exactly does this entail upon us? Well, come to our next quotation, which is also not far away, Genesis chapter 9. Now, Genesis chapter 9 is quite interesting because it's actually a set of laws that are supposed to apply to every human being who has ever lived. So God is talking about these laws in verse 5, Genesis 9 verse 5, and he says this, "And surely your blood of your lives will I require. At the hand of every beast will I require it, and at the hand of man. At the hand of every man's brother will I require the life of man. Whoso sheddeth man's blood, by man shall his blood be shed. For in the image of God made he man." Now, did you understand the point that these two verses were making? If you shed a man's blood, in other words, if you kill him, God requires that of us. He sees that as a violation of his law. But why is it a violation of God's law? Why does God care if a man is killed? Well, he gives his reason at the end of verse 6. "For in the image of God made he man." God made us in his image, and therefore it is a violation of God's law to violate a man. Now, turning back to Genesis 4 and the story of Cain and Abel, that's why it was wrong for Cain to murder Abel. If you're in Genesis 4, take a look at verse 10, where God is speaking and God says this. "And God said, what hast thou done? The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground." So the voice of Abel's blood cried to God from the ground. But this is actually, it's metaphorical language, but it's actually very similar language to Genesis 9 that we've just looked at, where God said this, "Surely the blood of your lives will I require." God requires justice for the spilled blood of men. And so the reason why it was wrong for Cain to murder Abel, and the reason why we all instinctively know that it was wrong, is because God has placed his own image and likeness, he placed it upon Abel, just like he had for Cain, and just like he has for all of us. And when we violate a person in God's image, or act in a way that desecrates that image, we devalue it, we deface it, we destroy it. And although we may not be consciously aware that that's what we're doing, that is why we are able to pass moral judgments when this happens. It's because we understand that a creature who bears God's image has value and has a responsibility, everyone has a responsibility to respect that value and not to desecrate it. So, to put the argument in a nutshell, especially for those who are more technically minded, this is it. Morality can only make sense if we presuppose that humans have inherent value. And the only worldview that coherently accounts for this is the biblical worldview, in which man was made in God's image. And those are the quotes that we've just looked at. And on this point, we can only conclude that God was the creator of mankind and the creator of the earth, which I believe satisfactorily answers tonight's title. You see, the wonder of creation is not only seen in the incredible design of all the animals that we see around us in nature, but it's actually also in our own minds as well, and in the very way we think and act. The proof is within our own selves, to the point where those who try to deny that God is the creator are without excuse. They should already know. Now, this is actually an argument made by the Bible itself in the book of Romans. If you'd like to turn up Romans chapter 1 with me, please. So Romans chapter 1, verse 18, we'll begin there, says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men, who hold the truth in unrighteousness, because that which may be known of God is manifest in them." And that actually seems to be the meaning of the Greek there. That which may be known of God is manifest in them. Or as the NASB says, within them. Verse 20 continues, "For the invisible things of him from the creation of the world are clearly seen, being understood by the things that are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse." So the record says that God's eternal power and Godhead, a phrase which actually sounds very similar to God's image and likeness, all of that should be obvious to everyone by the things that God has made, one of which is our own minds. And I believe that one of the points being made in these verses is that the proof lies within each one of us. The fact that we can reason and think like God, to pass moral judgments and to think in terms of right and wrong, that is an ability that we can only have because God stamped his image and likeness upon us when he created us. Now, I have to emphasize that I'm not claiming that everybody inherently knows what is right and wrong. Clearly, what I'm saying is that everybody has the ability to think in terms of right and wrong. Everybody has a conscience that tells them some things are morally wrong and some things are morally right. And whether or not our conscience gets it right all the time is beside the point. But unless you posit, as the Bible does, that humans have inherent value bestowed on them by something greater than themselves, then there is no justification for morality at all. If humans have no inherent value, then what can be wrong with stealing from one of them? What can be wrong with beating one of them up? What can be wrong with murdering one of them? But on the other hand, if we do have inherent value, then it would be wrong to violate that value. And we have an extremely solid basis for morality. And so the only worldview that makes sense of the fact that we can reason morally is a worldview in which humans have inherent moral value imposed on them by a divine creator. And I submit to you that the biblical account is the only way to come close to understanding this properly or coherently. And so to answer the question of tonight's title, "The Wonder of Creation, Proof of Divine Design," the proof is in your own conscience. And every time you pass a moral judgment in future, and every time a green Mazda cuts you off on the freeway, remember that your reaction is a testament to the God who created you with the ability to do that. Now, you might remember that towards the beginning of this talk, we considered an argument given by a lot of secularists. I think it's probably more of a complaint than an argument, that religious people should stop talking about questions that don't concern them. We should just leave questions about the natural origins of things to scientists. We should just accept whatever they tell us and say, well, granted that we're here, what should we do about it? What's our purpose? But I think based on what we've considered tonight, we can answer this complaint quite conclusively. You see, we've considered two perspectives tonight: the naturalistic atheistic perspective, in which there is no God, there is no objective morality, which basically means there's no morality at all, the result being that human beings are bunches of atoms bouncing around at a specific frequency. So that's the first perspective. The second perspective is that humans were created by God to be inherently valuable beings capable of representing God's character and his attributes in the earth, and capable of intelligent moral thought. And technically, both of these perspectives deal with the origin of mankind. Are we nothing more than neatly arranged stardust? Or is there something inherently valuable about us? So you can see that the question of where did humans come from is possibly the most spiritual question you could consider. And as people who study the Bible and hold dearly to the biblical standards for morality, we unashamedly challenge the mainstream views of today, views that threaten to destroy every single foundation that people have for morality. So let's turn to one final passage to conclude tonight's lecture, and the passage is in Mark chapter 12. This is a very interesting story, and we're going to read it, well, it's a short story. We're going to read it all the way through because it's only about 4 or 5 verses. And then we're going to take one final lesson from tonight's lecture. So Mark 12, verse 13, if you have it there. The record says this: "And they send unto him certain of the Pharisees," so this is Jesus we're talking about, "they send unto him certain of the Pharisees and of the Herodians to catch him in his words. And when they were come, they say unto him, Master, we know that thou art true, and carest for no man, for thou regardest not the person of men, but teachest the way of God in truth. Is it lawful to give tribute to Caesar, or not? Shall we give, or shall we not give? But he, knowing their hypocrisy, said unto them, Why tempt ye me? Bring me a penny, that I may see it. And they brought it. And he saith unto them, Whose is this image and superscription? They said unto him, Caesar's. And Jesus answering said unto them, Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, and to God the things that are God's. And they marveled at him." Now, there's actually a very good reason why they marveled at him. You see, his point was that if the coin had Caesar's image and name stamped upon it, then you should pay it to him as tribute. After all, it's his. It has his image stamped upon it. But in the subtext of this statement, what he's really saying is this: since God's image and name is stamped upon every one of us, then we should pay our own lives as tribute to God. So do you see that in the record? Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's, the things that have Caesar's image and superscription, and render to God the things that are God's, that have God's image and superscription. And so this is the lesson I'd like us to take away from tonight's lecture. In light of the fact, as I think I've proved this evening, that we are created in the image of God, we need to remember the responsibilities and the privileges that that places upon us, not only in how we treat other divine image bearers, but we also need to remember our responsibility to give our lives as a tribute to God, because when he created us, he stamped his own image and likeness upon us. He wants us to be like him. He wants us to develop his character and his attributes in our life. And if you'd like to know more about how to do that, I'd suggest that the only place to find out is in God's revealed word, the Bible. So we encourage you to look further into the issues that we've discussed tonight and spend time to search out the truth for yourself. Thank you.